You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. The journalist and author Sally Quinn has been writing headlines and been the subject of them for decades. She started at the Style section of the Washington Post and later went on to create their religion section on faith and also worked as a columnist. She was the wife of the late executive editor of the paper, Ben Bradley. Her new book is Finding Magic, a spiritual memoir published by Harper One. It's a vivid, uncensored, uninhibited memoir that embraces the importance of the spiritual realm in her everyday life. And I am so pleased it brings Sally Quinn, my friend and colleague from the Washington Post, back to the show. Welcome.
I'm so happy to be here and happy you're the host, Jonathan. It seems to me that every time I do the show, you're the host.
Every time you write a book, here I am.
I know.
Well, it's great to see you again. And, I met Ben Bradley and got to know him a little bit when I got to the paper in 2007. Maybe later on as we talk about the book, I'll tell, you know, that magical moment when I actually got to meet him. But let's start with you and start at the beginning. Talk a little bit about growing up in Georgia.
Well, I'm an Army brat, and so I grew up all over the world. And we never lived in one place longer than a year and a half. But I did, I'm from Savannah, Georgia. My mother is from Savannah. And we spent our summers in Savannah and Statesboro, Georgia. And it was a little tiny town near Savannah. And my ancestors, my relatives, were Scottish Presbyterians who had come down from North Carolina. And they were, my Aunt Ruth, they lived in this big plantation house, which had been in the McDougal family for years. And my Aunt Ruth was a Presbyterian lady who played the organ in church every Sunday. And we went to church. We were Christians and a Sunday school. But she also had this other side of her, which was her spiritual life was very much involved with the whole Scottish mysticism and the stones and time travel and ghosts and psychic phenomenon and astrology and that kind of thing, tarot cards, palmistry. And then the staff, the black staff who worked for us, many of whom were ancestors, whose ancestors had been slaves of the McDougal family, were Baptists. They were also Christian. They would go to their Baptist church across town, but they also practiced voodoo.
I was about to ask, because one of the words you didn't say was voodoo, and
yes.
I know voodoo figures prominently. Go on.
Right. And so, I grew up with this kind of compartmentalized religion, what I call embedded religion, where I was a Christian. I believed in God. I believed Jesus was the Son of God. I said my prayers. But I also believed in all of the Scottish mysticism, and I believed in voodoo because the staff was practicing voodoo at the house at other times. So this was not anything unusual. I mean, you would go to church, and that was part of what you believed, and this was also part of what you believed. And it's like being a Catholic and growing up and believing that if you sin, you're going to burn in hell for the rest of your life. And then you grow up and you think, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. But still, if you do something wrong, you think, oh my God, am I going to burn in hell? So there's always that part of me that I just accepted. And so you accept it emotionally. You're not intellectually,
none of it is in conflict. I would think being Christian, but also like saying voodoo and mysticism, there's no conflict.
One of the things, I started this religion website called On Faith, mm-hmm, for the Washington Post, and I took a trip around the world to study the great faiths, and they're all different, and a lot of them are the same. I mean, most of them have as their basic tenet the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And all of them have something that I find appealing and something that sort of resonates with me. And they're all different. So I kind of, I mean, a lot of people who are part of institutional religions and organized religions don't like the word cherry pick. Mm-hmm. But for me, it worked. I cherry picked the things out of every faith and every religion that I liked and that appealed to me and that worked for me. And so this was part of it. So that for me, there's no conflict about the things that you believe. You know, I ended up being an atheist. I actually started out being an atheist because my father was in the military and he liberated Dachau in World War II and the Nazi concentration mm-hmm. camp. And he took pictures, had a staff photographer take pictures of all of these corpses and that sort of thing. And I discovered the scrapbooks.
You discovered them in where in the house?
In the house. They were in this cabinet. And this was right after World War II. I was only four. And so I discovered these, and I didn't say anything for a while, but I was just horrified and fascinated to see these bodies and these emaciated people. And finally, I told my parents that I'd seen them, and my father sat down with me and said, explained who the Nazis were, and they were bad people. And I said, does God know about this? Mm. Did God know? And Daddy said, yeah, he did. And I said, well, how could he have let this happen? And he said, you know, what God does is a mystery to all of us. And I, that moment, thought, you know, I say my prayers to God every single night and ask him to protect me and my family. And all of these Jewish children were saying their prayers, and all of the Jewish grown-ups were saying their prayers, and God didn't listen to them. He didn't protect them. So why should he protect me? And I stopped believing in God, and I became an atheist when I was 4 years old.
And
I didn't know the word then. Uh-huh. I didn't learn it till I was 13.
So you were an atheist when it came to organized religion, but when it came to mysticism and voodoo, that was still...
Well, that was still, yeah. I mean, I didn't practice anything. It's just that it all seemed, you know, sort of the magic part of it seemed much more accessible to me and much less punishing. You know, mm-hmm. it was something that worked and that was mysterious and magical and it had a certain meaning to me.
I don't want to get off track here, but it's something that occurred to me as you were talking about discovering the pictures, your grandfather's pictures from World War II, from Dachau. The pictures.
Those are my father's pictures.
Your father's pictures. Yeah. Okay, I misunderstood because
that's because I look so young. You can't imagine.
Well, I'm bringing that up because it sort of seemed to be emblematic of what we hear and read about the Greatest Generation, and that is they did these incredible things. They liberated people. They saw horror and atrocities, and yet when they came home, they didn't talk about it. It was something. Think they didn't want to talk about it, and the fact that your father had these pictures but put them away and didn't talk to you about it until you found them, I thought was something quite powerful.
He never talked about World War II, and he served in Korea. He never talked about Korea, and when we were in Japan, stationed in Japan, when he went to Korea and he was fighting on the front, and I got very sick. I think partly because I was so worried about him, I ended up in the hospital in Tokyo mm-hmm. for almost a year, and I couldn't eat. I was on intravenous the entire time, and almost died. And they had a rule that children couldn't be visited by their parents, so I didn't see my parents and my mother for months at a time.
How old were you then?
I was 9 and 10. It was horrible, and I almost died. And Daddy came back, and I had surgery, and then I got better, and he went back to Korea, and then I had a relapse, and they put me on a hospital plane and to send me back to San Antonio, to Fort Brook General Hospital. And it was a plane filled with the most seriously wounded soldiers from Korea, most of them 17, 18, 19-year-old kids. And we were on a plane with litters that were five feet high. There were three rows of litters, five litters high, and they were all lying. And, of course, we were on litters, too. There was mm-hmm. no place to sit. And I was so sick. I was on an IV. And they were dying, and they were screaming, and they were crying. And my mother and my brother and sister and I were all on these litters, too. Mm. And mother would just go up and down the aisles. You know, blood was sort of pouring down from, you know, people had no limbs. They were seriously burned, and they were dying, and they would take their bodies away, and they were begging mother to... And she would go and sort of stroke their head and tell them they were loved. And it was just one of the most horrendous things I've ever seen. And so that was my up-close and personal view of war again. And again, I thought, how could an all-loving, all-powerful God mm-hmm. ever allow this to happen? It only reinforced my notion of being an atheist.
But as a child, witnessing that, that must have been traumatic. And your mother was with you. What did your mother say to you about what was happening around you, about the suffering of the people, the soldiers on the plane with you?
Well, I never said to her, how could God let this happen? Because at that point, I didn't believe in God. But, you know, there was no time to talk. We couldn't have a conversation. And she was literally spent all of her time going up and down the aisles, holding these guys' hands and taking letters to their mothers. And they were all screaming for their mothers. And that was the most heartbreaking thing of all. But we just never had a conversation about it. It was just part of our life.
Despite that moment, that horrific moment, that very eye-opening moment, would you say that overall your growing up was insulated or in a bit of a bubble?
Well, you know, my father was a general from the time I was 11 or 12. And so certainly, and by that time he was finished with war. He never went back to war again. And so we traveled every year and a half. But so you do live in a bubble if you're a general's daughter. You know, you live in these beautiful quarters and all of that. But you do move so that your family is the sort of central unit in your mm-hmm. life. And so you learn to adapt and to move and to change and grow.
And how would you describe your relationship with your parents?
Oh, well, I had the most loving parents. I mean, my mother was my closest friend until the day she died. I mean, she was the most wonderful mother anybody could ever have. And my father was, you know, the general, but he was incredibly loving and supportive. I mean, I had great parents, and I was with both of them when they died. I literally was holding on to them when they died, as I was with my husband, Ben, mm-hmm. when he died.
Who do you think you're most like?
Oh, I think I'm much more like my mother. Although a lot of my friends do point out that I'm a warrior's daughter.
And that
I am a warrior on some level.
What do they mean by that, a warrior's daughter?
Well, that, you know, I'm very strong. And some people think that I'm courageous. And I don't, you know, I care deeply about certain things. My father was a real chauvinist about our country. And so I have very deeply held values from my growing up, a sense of honor and a belief in the country and the things that our country stands for. And I'm very resilient, and I don't give up. I just don't give up ever. But my mother was a wonderful person, and she also loved people. She loved people. They were both very gregarious, and she loved parties, and she loved to be around people, and everybody adored my mother. And I can't say enough. I'm so lucky because so many people don't have great relationships with their parents. And you know, so when I had my son Quinn, who's now 35, I didn't know any other way to be a parent than be totally loving and just to give him everything. He was born with a hole in his heart and had open heart surgery when he was 3 months old and nearly died. And he was in the hospital most of the time until he was about 16. And so I was with him. I basically gave up my career during mm-hmm. that time when Ben was editor of the Washington Post.
And we're going to talk about Ben Bradley a little bit later, but we have to take a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with the one and only Sally Quinn. Her latest memoir is Finding Magic, a spiritual memoir. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate, and I am speaking with Sally Quinn about her new book, Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir. You know, we started out talking about how you're an atheist from like a little tot, 4 years old. As you said, you didn't know the meaning of the word at the time. And talking about voodoo and mysticism and You reminded me that your book is split into into three sections: magic, mystery, and meaning. Before we get into the interesting stories in the book, why did you divide the book up in that way?
Well, because ultimately, and I didn't think of it right away, but because when I started writing the book, I had signed a book contract three or four years before I started writing it. And then Ben started his decline into dementia. And the last 2 years, I just couldn't write. I just didn't write anything. I couldn't do it. I just was so involved in his caretaking. And so it was only a couple of weeks after he died that I began to write the book. And I had to get out the last 2 years and his decline and his death. It just was really important for me to write that. And I didn't even know where it was going to go in the book. In fact, I thought it might be the beginning of the book. But I knew that I needed to write that. And ultimately, that ends up being the last part of the book and the meaning part of the book, what that meant to me and what his life was like. And I started the magic part because of my early life in Georgia but believing in magic and telling. The book is full of stories. It's all stories. And each story is some moment in my life that was illuminating or magical or instructive or that had some sense of the divine or some sense of transcendence. And they weren't all positive stories, but things that resonated with me and had a huge importance to me. And so I started with magic, but then it was kind of like I didn't know what it was that I wanted to write. And so that's where the mystery came in, the whole thing of being an atheist and yet starting a website on religion when I was an atheist that nobody could believe. Nobody still can believe it, actually. Neither could Ben. But I suddenly realized that there was all this mystery that I didn't have my hand on and that I couldn't define. But it was something that there was some sort of creator. I couldn't wrap my mind around the idea that first there was nothing and then there was something. And even though I didn't believe in God, it was quite clear that I was riveted by the topic of religion and the fact that 95% of the people in this world are informed by their faith. Something had to be going on. What was it? And so that was the second part of the book, was really sort of trying to discover the mystery of faith and the meaning. I took a trip around the world to study all these religions, and I saw all of these things, and things began to make sense to me. And I started doing a lot of reading and studying about religion. I became more and more consumed by it, and I still am. I mean, the whole idea of faith and belief and religion, I just find the best conversation you can have. And, you know, you can start talking about it and never end. And then so the last part was really about meaning. And I was supposed to finish the book in November, and I realized that I just hadn't gotten to where I was. And so I had to postpone it because I realized that I had to sort of figure out the meaning of life. And I only had 3 months because I was on deadline. So
figure out the meaning of life.
So I had to figure it out. But I did for myself anyway. I did come to some conclusions that were really important to me, and only really in the last few months, toward the end of writing the book, which it's taken me about 2.5 years to do.
And as you said, you know, your life with Ben Bradley, it figures prominently in the meaning part of the life. And we've mentioned his name many times, and a lot of the listeners know who Ben Bradley is. But we have to talk about him because he is a larger-than-life figure. He was your husband. He is Quinn's father. I mentioned at the start of the interview that in 2007, Don Graham, then the publisher of the Washington Post, came by my office and said, "Hey, Jonathan, you want to come to lunch with me and Ben Bradley and Walter, the national security guru?" And I said, "I'm covering this hearing. I think it's Alberto Gonzalez. I can't make it." And Don had this look of disappointment on his face. But luckily, they adjourned for lunch. I emailed Don and I said, "Hey, I can make it for lunch." And there, I go to the Madison Hotel across from the old, now gone, Washington Post building, and I got to meet Ben Bradley, who was as irascible and jocular as I had read and heard. He was totally un-Washington, which I loved about him, from the way he dressed to the way he talked. And I remember saying, "Oh, Mr. Bradley," he's like, "Call me Ben." And I would call him Ben, just like giggling. This legend is telling me to call him Ben. And then I would see him in the building and I would say, "Hi, Ben." He'd say, "Hi, Jonathan." But then as time went on, I noticed that he didn't recognize me. And I just chalked it up to, well, he knows everybody in this building and it's okay. But then as the years got on, I realized something's not well with Ben. When did you realize that Ben was not
well? Well, he started, what started me thinking there was something wrong, and I write about this in the book, was that he we had a fabulous marriage. I mean, we were really madly in love with each other from the moment we got together until the moment he died. But there was this awful period about 8 years, 8 or 9 years before he died, where his personality started changing. And he became sort of irascible and irritable and sometimes outright hostile toward me only, not anybody else. And I was just devastated because I didn't know what was going on. And I kept thinking, how could he talk to me this way? How could he be this way with me? He's always been so loving. So we finally went to a psychiatrist. And we would sit in the psychiatrist's office and I would say, "Well, Ben said this to me and this and this and this." And he'd say, "I never said that. How could I possibly talk to you that way? I love you. I would never say that." And I thought he was gaslighting me. Well, of course, that... And then the fact that he started becoming very forgetful suddenly made me realize that there was a problem. And so I convinced him to have a test, and he was tested positive for dementia. And that was 8 years before he died. And so then I started reading up on it. I realized that your personality does change and people become angry and hostile. And Ben was never that way. I mean, he was always so outgoing and loving and kind and generous and fun.
How did he react to the test when it came back that he had dementia?
You know, it was very funny. I mean, I think Ben always had this sort of greatest sense of denial. And I have none. I have no capacity for denial, but he did. And he just kind of accepted it. He never got depressed about it. We didn't talk about it. It was just, this is what it was. And nothing, it's so slow, dementia. Nothing changes radically. I think the worst moment was when I had to take the car keys away from him. But it just gradually, and the friends started noticing that Ben was forgetful, and we'd make jokes about Ben couldn't remember where the keys were, and he'd forget his glasses and all that. And it wasn't until he was speaking to a group of people, CEOs in New York, and being interviewed by John Meacham, who was my co-moderator at On Faith. He was the editor of Newsweek. And Ben had a blackout the day before. We had on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum. And I thought maybe he seemed to have lost a little bit. And I said, "Maybe you shouldn't do this." No, I'm going to be fine." And he got up in front of all these people. Mm-hmm. And John Meacham was trying to interview him, and he couldn't answer the questions. He didn't remember when he'd been editor. He couldn't answer anything about World War II. It was horrible. I was about to faint. I was so upset. I had a knot in my stomach. And he finally looked at me and just helplessly, I was sitting in the front row, and said, "Sally, help me."
I heard about this.
And it was just, I thought I was going to die. And so I realized then that we had to tell people about it. And that was 2 years before he died that we actually started talking about how he had dementia. And then everything changed.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how you met, because you met at the Washington Post. You were a brand new reporter at the Style section. And how long after you started at the Post did you see Ben Bradley?
Well, I had actually met him before I went to work for the Post, because the editor of the editorial page had hired me to be his secretary and took me in to meet Ben. And I was completely dazzled. I mean, I was like meeting the Sun King, you know. And then I got fired before I started working because he said, "Look, you know, you're overqualified and this will never work." And so
But Ben didn't fire you.
The editor, Phil Shela, who was a great friend of mine, but he said, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, because you can't do this, because we'll hate each other, because you don't want to be a secretary and you can't type in a file.
You can't do any of the secretarial things.
But then about a year or so later, I got a call from Ben. This voice said, Ben Bradley, you don't remember me, and I said, yes, I do. And he said, I'd like to talk to you about being a reporter in Style. And he just started Style about 2 months earlier. And so I went in to interview him, and we had this very sort of sparring relationship. I think I was very cheeky at the time, because here he was, the editor of the Post, and he was 20 years my senior. But we really, it just was sort of magic. It really was magic. I mean, we were just clicked. Mm-hmm. And he hired me, and he said, can I see something you've written? I said, well, I've never written anything. And he said, well, nobody's perfect. And he hired me, and I went out and covered my first story. And it wasn't until about 4 years later that we went down to the Miami convention, and the Post travel people had put us next to each other on the plane. And it was a 2-hour flight. It was a bumpy flight. And I was sort of grabbing onto him. I'm not a good flyer. But at the end of the flight, I was completely in love with him. And I later learned that he was in love with me. But nothing happened until a year later. And during Watergate. This was all during Watergate.
But, I mean, at the time, you had to keep this relationship secret. And there is lots of gossip going around.
Well, there was nothing going on between us for that whole year. I wrote him a couple of love notes, but they were anonymous, and he was so thick that he never even figured out who wrote them.
Did you put any clues in the love letters so that he could figure it out?
No, it would be based on some encounter we'd had in the newsroom. I would sort of make an oblique reference to it, but he didn't get it. And then I realized I was so much in love with him. I got offered the job to be the first network anchor woman in America, to be the CBS Morning News anchor with Hughes Rudd. I didn't want the job, but I took it because I had to get away from Ben. I just couldn't stand it anymore. And so I took the job, moved up to New York, and came back and asked him to take me to lunch. And I had rehearsed my little spiel, and I said, I'm leaving because I'm in love with you. And I thought he would say, there, dear girl, you know, go live with your boyfriend, which I was doing. And he said, I can't believe this, because I've been in love with you all of this time too. And so we got together that night, and then I started the CBS Morning News, and we didn't tell anybody for about 3 months, because, you know, I was doing all this publicity tour. And so it wasn't until about this time of year and mid-September that we finally did get together.
But there is lots of speculation going on. Were the focus of gossip.
I don't remember that. Honestly, I don't remember that we were ever the focus of gossip during that time, because nobody knew that there was nothing going on between us.
So you didn't sort of feed into a little bit like, hey, what's going on? Do you know who?
Well, after he left his wife in the end of June. And so then from that time on, you know, my friends would call me up and say, you know, Ben Bradley has left, and apparently for somebody else, who could it be? And I would say, well, I can't imagine. But that was that was only about 2 months that went on.
It took him a while to ask you to marry him.
It certainly did.
You cajoled him. You threatened him.
I did.
You're like, look, if you don't marry me, I'm going to go have an affair with somebody.
That's
and
right.
I've got someone in mind.
Right.
Who was it?
It was Azer Weitzman.
Oh, the Israeli
Israeli defense minister. Well, I had no intention of doing that, but I decided that I would, because I had to go to Israel.
Right.
I decided that I would threaten him with that, because Ben, you know, we would live together for 5.5 years, and I really wanted to get married, and we had planned to get married. And mm-hmm. then he just said, you know, I've been married twice before. I'm not good at it. And we have this perfect relationship, and I don't want to be a 3-time loser. And I'm afraid if we get married, I won't be able to do it.
And then another time that you...
By the way, it worked.
Well, right. You got married. And another time you threatened him and it worked. It was when you decided you wanted a baby.
We had a deal that we weren't going to have children. But I was then almost 40. I was 40, and I suddenly just had baby hunger. I had to have a baby, and he just refused for a couple of years, actually. And I finally said to him, I have to have a baby. And so if it's not yours, it's going to be somebody
else. I was
going to
say, it was either going to be yours or someone else. And you also said then, I have someone in mind.
Yes.
Who was it?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to tell.
Oh, come on. All right. In the little bit of time that we have left, I cannot have you here and not talk about the hexes. You write about putting hexes on people.
Right.
And then those people... no longer
go
being
ahead
with us.
And say it.
They died.
I know. Well, let me just say that when you talk about, this is part of my earlier life, when you talk about hexes, I think it's part of a Southern cultural thing, like in New Orleans or Savannah.
Right.
Everybody's got voodoo dolls and they put hexes on people. But a hex can be a spell. It also can be, a hex is really not any different from a wish or a prayer even, because it can be a good one or a bad one.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that you want somebody to die. It means that you want them to feel the same kind of pain that they have made you feel. And so this was 35 years ago, or no longer, 40 years ago. I did put a couple of hexes on people. I had no idea what I was doing, and I had never done it before, and I didn't know whether it would work or not. I mean, I just wanted them to go away. I wanted to sort of banish them.
They literally went away. I mean,
and they literally did. And my brother, who is a PhD in religion from the University of Chicago and studied mystery with Mercedes Eliade, who is one of the great religion scholars, he studied mysticism, and he said, you know, you got to cut this out. But Ben, I told all my friends about it, and they all died laughing. They thought it was hysterical.
Right, I'm chuckling now too, but one of the people you put a hex on was Clay Felker.
That's right.
New York Magazine, right. You put a hex on him.
Yes.
And poof, do you?
Well, it wasn't quite poof. I mean, he did get fired right away, but then he got sick. And
Do you think that...
But Jonathan, here's the thing. Ben thought it was ridiculous. He thought it was total nonsense. So did all my friends. I didn't intellectually believe it either. There's this moment where it's like embedded religion. You're sort of thinking, oh, my God, you know. I ask people when they ask me about it, and I'm going to ask you, what do you think?
I'm scared.
No, really. What do you think? I mean, the thing is,
I don't know,
because people, you know, I think that there is a power of suggestion, and
right,
obviously in all faiths, all religion. I mean, if you pray, you know, people will, you know, will pray that Saddam Hussein dies, or that Hitler dies, or that, Assad dies, or they will pray that ISIS goes away, or that they will get killed, or something like that. Or they pray for someone's well-being, or someone's health, or recovery, or whatever. So it's a matter of faith, and it's a matter of belief. Now, I intellectually do not believe this, but I have to say that after three times, I got really spooked. And I mean, Ben used to say he'd laugh about it, and then, you know, he'd get pissed off at someone, and he'd say, "Oh, go get him, Sal." You know, I mean, it was just, it was always a joke. So but I ask you, because you would have as much idea of whether I was responsible or not.
All I can say is I would not want to get on your bad side. and with that, I'm going to have to leave it there, Sally. It's so great to see you. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with the one and only of my friend, Sally Quinn, about her latest book, Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir. Tonight at 7 o'clock, she will be speaking at Barnes & Noble on 86th and Lex. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate Sally. Thanks so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you.